On this episode of The Advice Show...
Technical competence is absolutely key, but actually the really important differentiating skill is emotional intelligence. It is being able to have the conversation that AI can then analyze.
But first, a quick word from our sponsor.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, and welcome to The Advice Show from CityWire, where we dig into the ideas, insights, and industry shakeups driving the world of financial planning. My guest today is Alex Twiss from Connor Broadley. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alex, do you want to kick off by telling our listeners a bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to this current role?
Yes, well, my background has always been in investments, actually, and I started off my career coming to Connor Broadley as a sort of young 21, 22-year-old as the first investment analyst on our desk, just as we were launching an investment service to complement our financial planning service. And it was a really great opportunity because when you join a smaller firm that's growing and has the right ambitions and strategy, you get this great ability to help shape the process in a way you might not otherwise get at a larger firm. So that experience allowed me to sort of garner some skills doing the intellectual property generation of the investment side, the investment selection research process, but then also the operational side. So being able to build out the systems, the processes, the portfolio management tools that would then allow us to be the business we are today. And those tools, I think, helped set me up for a transition in about 2022, 2021. To move over into management to help try and upskill the operational and strategic direction of the firm in some of the avenues that are now, I think, critical. But back then, maybe the market was slower to sort of adopt, whether that be technology, et cetera.
Yeah. So the business, Connor Broadley, it's an NMA top 100 firm. Assets just under 700 million, I believe.
Now it's 750 million.
Okay.
And we were looking at the exchange rate with the dollar. And I just yesterday noted that we'd surpassed $1 billion, which seems like a nice milestone.
It sounds better, doesn't it?
It does.
But yeah, you just want to tell us a bit about the firm, you know, the history and how you define yourselves as a business.
Absolutely. So the firm was founded in 2007 as a independent financial planning firm. And it was really founded to try and get ahead of some of the things that RDR then came in to enforce in our industry, which was, you know, really focused on best practice, putting the client first, high quality personal service. And that was very successful. And by the time we got to 2011, the founders, James and Peter, felt that they could do something similar in the investment space. And so having gone through the experience of the global financial crisis very early in their time at Connor Broadley, they recognized that there might be another way of managing portfolios that meant there was greater synergy between the portfolio performance and the risk profiles. There wasn't this dispersion where perhaps the largest portfolios perhaps had a different trajectory to the smallest. So they launched the investment team in 2011-12, which is when I joined. And that then became the foundation of our business today, which is a financial planning-led wealth manager, but one where if I were to articulate our difference to our peers, where we put equal emphasis on the quality of the service for both. And perhaps one observation I have is, depending on, you know, the origin of your business in our space, there are some financial planning firms who have somewhat bolted on investment management, but it's perhaps not a core service. It's perhaps a sort of add-on that helps drive a bit of extra revenue, but might not have the same resource and team behind it. And equally hopping to the other side, there are, you know, the discretionary fund management firms who are increasingly bolting on a financial planning service. But again, that can sometimes feel like a slightly more junior service proposition that's there if you want it, but not a core part of what you present to clients. And really, we try to be right in the middle of those where the quality of both is really high, such that, and the integration between both is really strong in a way that makes clients feel like there's a one-stop shop here that's going to really be high quality across both practices.
And do you call yourselves a financial planning business, or do you call yourselves a wealth manager?
We call ourselves a wealth manager, but the very clear thing we say in all of our opening lines, and this is particularly true of me now in management, having come from the investment desk, is to stress how important it is that we are financial planning led. And as I see our industry evolve, you know, the real bespoke, personal and attentive side has to come from the financial planning. That's where the relationship is forged. That's where trust is built. That is where understanding all the idiosyncrasies and all of the hopes, desires, fears, assets, liabilities comes from. And that's understanding is what lays the basis for good wealth management. And the investment side has to be very high quality, but it can then be a little more, right, well, we have a job, a very distinct brief, and we're going to do it to the best of our ability and focus in on that and allow the financial planning side to handle the permutations that clients go through when it comes to navigating markets and their lives.
Yeah.
Financial circumstances.
I mean, on the kind of the name, not to get too fixated on it, but I know your kind of client base are probably a bit higher than the typical firm in terms of, you know, you're obviously a London firm, quite high net worth client base. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think when we think about our strategy, we have two demographics we target. The first has probably been around for longer, which has been essentially the one to, you know, £10 million client with investable assets in that range. And really, for us, that's trying to recognize that there is a space that I think the private banks have abdicated, have removed themselves from as their minimums get higher and higher. And there is, you know, some very fantastic clients who might not have been receiving the service that they were expecting at the lower ends of those private banking minimums. And that's been a core part of our proposition and, you know, our average.
So what, taking clients in private banks?
That, and also the people who would have been private bank clients. Yeah. And bringing them on in-house.
What do they kind of say about the service?
Well, you know,
not
this
to
is
name
not,
names here.
Yeah, this is not to try and say that this is the experience for all private banks. But I think if you are on that threshold, so I can think of one instance where you're sort of in the sort of £5 to £6 million realm. Well, sometimes you'll have a relationship manager whose job is to really look at the product suite that the private bank offers and cross-sell those into this one individual client.
Do you want this private market funds?
Yeah, exactly that. And that can leave it feeling a bit reactive and a bit disjointed.
Also very salesy, I imagine, as well.
Yes. And then I guess the alternative, if you're then contrasting it with the experience we try and offer, you have now a chartered financial planner who is highly, highly, highly proficient, who is almost your financial concierge, managing everything and understanding proactively what is in your best interest and coordinating that and implementing that.
Which is often saying, you shouldn't buy this product, or this might not be a good idea.
So often. And it's really where the culture of the firm stands out, because the best interest of the client will always come first from any commercial element. You know, James, the founder, very much drummed that into us early doors, which was the adage when we were onboarding a client: listen, we're going to be very happy when you come to withdraw this money, because that's what we're doing this for. We're curating it, we're structuring it, we're developing it so that you can use it. And that, I think, is a slight disconnect for some of the industry, which has always been about just retention in a sense.
Yeah. And Alex, in your current role, so you've got many different hats. I think we were just talking about this coming from the investment side, but then also kind of some of the operational side and managing financial planners, I guess. And managing financial planners is a notoriously difficult task. You know, they're often quite hard people to manage. I think that's fairly well established. How do you find that job, and kind of what are the key lessons you've learned along the way?
Well, I will say that our head of compliance formerly line manages the financial planners, and she does a fantastic job on that front. But having said that, coordinating them as a unit is something that sort of fits in that management function. And we are, I think, relatively different to our peers in that the average age of our chartered financial planners is 37 years old. And we all sit in one office, which is open plan. And so the coordination and the integration of our planners into the wider business is very strong.
So they have to be in the office like a certain number of days a week?
So we set out a policy quite early on in 2021 of having our whole business in the office 4 days a week as a default, with everyone taking the same day to work from home on a Friday, mm-hmm. recognizing that there is a real important collaborative element to the work that we do, personal integration and touch being really important. And our fear was if we went too far down the other routes, which was far fewer days spread out across whenever days you wanted to come in, you wouldn't really ever get the benefit of everyone being in together and creating that company culture and that morale and driving for those higher standards. So we've implemented that. Now, clearly, we're a very understanding firm. So when there are personal issues that require a deviation from that, of course, we're accepting of it. But the default is to try and ensure people are together. Yeah. So the management is fantastic on that front.
It makes it easier then, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. It makes it easier in terms of understanding what's going on, who's capacity constrained, what the challenges are for them as individuals and practitioners, and equally for us to ensure that the culture that we've been building and fostering so carefully is maintained as we grow.
Yeah, and I think I understand that you cap client numbers to per planner.
We do.
100, what's the number?
So it depends on the complexity of the case, but it tends to be somewhere between 80 and 100 households. That's is a recognition that to deliver the high touch service that we want, there has to be the time to do it. Yeah. And very often my view is that the service becomes transactional and pretty depersonalized. If you get to numbers more akin to 150, 200 households, it becomes far more of a factory line than it is a personal relationship.
But do you ever get pushback from financial planners saying, you know, like I've got 95 clients and I've got these prospects and I want to take on these clients, and you guys say, you've got to say no, this is your limit. Do you ever get pushback from that side of things?
I think we don't get overt pushback because we've been very upfront about how we want to manage that book. So the truth of the matter is that we have to then also drive efficiencies on their side in order to allow them to extend the same service to more and more households. So that's the first thing. And you know, we can come to talk about how we've been embracing AI to help in that process across the course of last year. The second is that there is a natural ability for newer clients to be rotated through to up-and-coming members of the team who have gone through their training process and are, you know, getting into the chartered position, and equally perhaps to take on some of the book of a more experienced older planner, mm-hmm. who, you know, might think that planner is a better fit, and very carefully handle that transition on. And so far, we've had real success there. We would never transition a client to a new member of the team if it wasn't going to be the client's in the client's best interest, or they wouldn't be happy with that change. Very often, we'll say no, we'll stick with the incumbent planner. But there is a slight move across the divisions of the business in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And having a young financial planning team, I mean, obviously, it comes with this kind of advantages, but are there any of drawbacks you get? I mean, do you get some clients kind of reticent to take on a financial planner who might be in their late 20s or early 30s?
Absolutely. There are sometimes those initial preconceptions about, well, this person may not have gone through the same stages of life that I'm currently going through, or are feeling that worried about going through. Mm-hmm. Typically, though, what will happen is the planner will have had enough experience, given that, you know, we are a chartered status firm and all of our planners, I think bar one developing planner, are chartered. They can talk to, having helped so many of their clients through that same journey, and talk with a level of technical competence and understanding that is reassuring to that person. So we get it, but not nearly as frequently as you'd think. And almost always that feeling is temporary on the behalf of our clients and gives way to the quality of the proposition being profit.
Yeah. And Alex, you mentioned this, a new AI tool you've brought in for your planners last year. Can you tell us about this? What was the tool and how is it helping or not helping?
Absolutely. So we ran a tender process sort of midway through last year to look for a financial planning AI tool that was going to support the efficiency of the team. It was one of the most interesting vendor selection processes we've run. It's fair to say that
it's not RFP. Is it an RFP?
You send out RFPs, you do your due diligence on the providers in the space, but that is what, you know, when we moved custodian, for example, that was the very formal process that we ran. But in this space, all the businesses are relatively young.
They're all startups, aren't they?
Yeah, founded in 2023, 2024. the proposition they're offering is evolving at such a breakneck speed that actually you aren't really capable of putting, you know, classic matrix of who's best or who's worst side by side. By the time you put it together, it's out of date. So you end up having to look more broadly at the vision of the firm, the founders, the strategy they're employing. And it's a bit like going back to my investment days and looking at those sort of seed and angel investing and saying, do you know what? I think that this firm has either the dominant position or will have the dominant position and will maintain that. And this is where the proposition will be in 5-10 years time. And that process led us to Saturn, who I think has captured the dominant market share in our industry now.
Yeah, I mean, so many top 100 firms are using them these days.
And really being very careful about how we manage that process. So clearly data security was such an important facet of the RFP process. And they were, I think, the gold standard very early doors. They strategically recognized that was going to be a key concern to overcome for us in a regulated environment. And then the quality of the actual large language models, the orchestration layer they used and the interface that planners use has been really great and has really freed up some of those more procedural tasks of capturing the nature of a conversation, being able to categorize it into the FCA handbook dedicated sections to be able to spit out action points that are then auditable by not just the planner and his support team or her support team, but the wider business as well.
So remind our listeners kind of what exactly it does. It transcribes client meetings and then produces notes on the meetings.
It does. It's actually gone one level further than just the pure transcription. That was definitely stage one of AI, which was we'll just transcribe the notes and then use the text in order to disseminate summaries and then populate fact finds and database data in our systems. But the next generation is actually analyzing the audio of that meeting as well to try and pick up on some of the non audio cues that help determine stress or sarcasm, etc. So it's even evolved since then. But yes, it is broadly capturing the content of the meeting. It's helping populate all the different sections that the FCA would require for you to have had on an onboarding prospect or an ongoing client.
So then it feeds into your back office system.
We currently have it feeding into our data lake as opposed to into our back office system.
Okay.
Again, we're talking more into the sort of tech side.
Yeah.
But one of the, when you talk about the tech stack, one of the things I think is really important is a firm owns its own data and doesn't necessarily have it held hostage in any one system. So very much a lot of what we try and do is ensure that whichever tool we use, the data that we want is taken out on a daily basis and populating our own SQL servers and data lake. So it goes there. And then from our perspective, it's about continually working with Saturn as they build out the functionality. So at the moment, it's very much file notes and meeting summaries, and it helps extract policy information that helps with the LOA chasing process. But the next iteration is going to be when it comes to helping with, you know, actual report writing and equally being able to assess vulnerabilities and a whole host of other initiatives around compliance as well. So it's a very exciting development pathway and one that I can see having real synergies for our team. And again, key thing for us to deliver is freeing them up to spend more time giving the actual advice with our clients.
And you think that's where they're going to, their direction of travel then, kind of report writing?
So I think report writing will definitely be something that they'll be able to do. I think it always has to be a human in the loop, an advisor in the loop, because it will never be perfect. But what it will do is at least allow you to have a first copy that will take a chunk of the more procedural work, the bit that a planner would typically knock out very quickly and without much thought because they've done it hundreds of times before, and allow them to focus more of their energy onto the more technical aspects of it.
And this is both for initial advice and ongoing suitability reports?
That will be the roadmap. It's not there yet, to be clear.
Yeah.
And equally, we wouldn't want to launch anything into a live environment with our planners until we'd really tested it. But that's where we're going. And it's, I think, you know, if you even look past that and, you know, the thought of perhaps having even an AI agent that's in the room with you as a planner that's going to help allow you to, you know, ask questions or be able to prompt you on certain bits that you might not have discussed. That's the direction of travel I think eventually some of these tools will get to. And it's interesting because it then also says, okay, well, as a firm, if that's the direction of travel that the technology is going, you know, what is our reaction as a firm as to how to best make use of that, how to best hire, what's the skill sets that we need? And for us, that then comes back to technical competence is absolutely key, but actually the really important differentiating skill is emotional intelligence. It is being able to have the conversation that AI can then analyze that will cover all the aspects of the advice, but equally help unlock all of the things that the AI bot doesn't know, which is, you know, what are your hopes? What are your fears? What are your financial realities? The things that aren't said as much as the things that are said, creating that trust to be able to then truly deliver a great plan for that client rather than coming up with a very generic plan that the client doesn't contest, but actually probably could have been far better codified for them.
So in terms of recruitment, then you'd be looking more at the emotional intelligence of planners rather than, you know, their technical pensions and tax knowledge, like going forward. If you were to look for a new planner for the next, well, you'd hope they'd be with you for many years, but that's what you look for then going forward.
You would definitely need to have both, but the emotional intelligence tends to be the thing that is a skill set that's harder to nurture. So you can nurture it, but if you're hiring someone bright, you think with right processes around their development, you're going to get them to the technical competence. Or if there is something that they're unsure of, there is a technical competent person in the team that can assist them in that.
Or an AI agent.
Yes. And then more importantly, though, being able to create that trust and being able to get that information from a client is such a skill set. And then managing them through the challenges that their life throws at them and markets throw at them and keeping them on the plan. You know, if you think about where the possibility to really dent your financial future can come from, it is making sure that when emotions are high around market falls or personal challenge, that you don't make a decision in a moment that then really you struggle to recover from. And so there is an element of that almost coaching, counseling, education that a financial planner needs to have, and I think will increasingly need to have going forward.
But as a firm, are you kind of sitting there thinking, you know, in 10 years' time, will people be getting their financial planning from ChatGPT? You know, will this eat our lunch in terms of what demands will be and what the services will be available?
So my view is we'll see where AI will get to in 10 years' time. But as it currently looks on the next five-year view, I actually don't think that will be the way it works directly, because actually having the conversation and understanding the things you need to even ask it are really important. And I've seen it in other industries, but when you as an individual ask a very generic, non-financially trained AI question, one, it's giving you a summation of sometimes not even the specific regulatory regime you're operating in. Yeah. Two, it doesn't know what it doesn't know. So the biases in the prompting and the questioning you're asking it might give you a response back that actually isn't what you need, but you might be overconfident now that you've been told that's fact.
I guess people could just say, what funds are going to make me the most money in the next 10 years or whatever?
Yeah, all those sorts of things. And actually what's really important is that technically proficient but emotionally intelligent person in the room who's having the conversation with you, because that is then the prompts that it is needed for AI to do its best work, because it's helping it work out what it really needs to focus on, rather than perhaps picking up on the biases of its clients and playing back what they want to hear. I think we've all had that experience with AI chatbots where you ask it a question and the first response is always a great question, Jack. Great question, Alex. And, you know, I'm sure it will evolve from that point of view, but there has to be a highly technical person in the loop and an emotionally intelligent person in the loop as it stands currently.
Okay, interesting. And I guess if we look at the broader tech stack that Connor Broadley's got, so you've got, you know, you're implementing Saturn AI. You have your own custodian, though. You use
SCI. And then we use Xplan as the
back office
CRM. And really, as I said, and then we use Voyant for cash flow modeling.
Yep.
But for each of those, we want it to be a core part of the proposition that we're making the best use of, that we are adopting what it does best rather than constantly trying to adapt a system. But at its core, it's about taking all the data that sits in those systems, extracting it, having it in our own data lake, and being able to then come up with fantastic uses for that. So, for example, all of our investment management review reports are generated for all of our clients every month automatically because of the way that we digest all the information on all the systems and are able to then use a sort of Python overlay to generate beautiful looking reports that we have designed to not look like the rest of the industry and come from, you know, our creative founding clients' backgrounds, something that it just makes sense visually. And those are the things that will increasingly become important. And I feel like it's the bigger differentiator between the smaller firms and the larger firms when you have that complete, accurate data across all your systems and you have a very focused business model. You know who you're targeting and you know how to service them really well. You can automate and help that process the most as a management team.
And is there anything you're looking for in terms of new technology or anything that you think you're kind of scoping out as something you could add to your tech stack? Or,
well, I think the first thing is that some of the providers that we currently have, you know, we keep encouraging them to be a little more sort of API first in their mindset, yeah, to allow greater access through developer tools to their systems, to allow the automations to flow through, so they're minimizing double keying and those sorts of pieces, and be comfortable with businesses fully integrating with them in that regard as a way of demonstrating stickiness of a relationship longer term. So that would be probably the biggest challenge I'd put back to all incumbents in this space, which is think about how deeply you can integrate with your clients, be offering up things rather than hiding them behind paywall walls. Think about it as an investment in the duration of the relationship rather than a shorter term way to generate extra revenue or protectively try and keep business. And the best incumbents in the space have built their systems that way. So that'd be the first. When it comes to AI, you know, we've focused a lot on the advice side, but I think going forward over time, it's about looking at how it can help with the broader operations of the business as well, and what it can do in terms of the reporting and the analytics that sits across the business, so from a business management perspective. And then even on the investment side, which is a core piece, I don't see it ever getting to the point in the near term, certainly, where it's making investment decisions. Perhaps where it's an overlay that is helping analyzing those decisions in real time, helping spot where there may be a bias or there may be something that seems a little out of process that's creeping up and flagging those things.
Mm. And looking at your top 100 entry for us last year, Alex, I think you mentioned three things when it comes to new clients, which is data, reputation and word of mouth and networking. So these are the three kind of pillars that you use to get new business coming in. Can you tell us a bit about this, kind of what your strategy is here for getting new business?
Absolutely. So I think as a slightly smaller firm in this space, without the many billions under management, without the name recognition on the streets, it poses a unique challenge to find clients. And really what we've observed is that the way that we manage clients, that highly personal touch, means that the best way that we'll get a new prospect through the door is when someone they trust taps them on the shoulder at the right point in time and says,
this is the word of mouth.
You should really speak to Connor Broadley. And for us, the goal is to try and extend that network of trusted individuals to be as wide as possible and ensure that all those people we know we can help the most, there is someone near them that would tap them on the shoulder and say, you should really go speak to Connor Broadley. And so that tends to be, you know, working with third parties and being able to articulate to them, whether it be law firms, accountants, and a whole host of other industries, how we're different from the others in the space, having a clear message, being able to say, we'd do a great job for this type of client and say, but equally, this type of client wouldn't be for us. And helping build that trust with an ongoing relationship and doing a great job when we get a referral through. So that's a really core strand. So it's growing through that method. Events are a great way of helping with that, being able to provide the catalyst to show some of the quality things that we do.
So you bring your clients to the events and then they bring their friends?
Bring their clients to the events, friends, third parties. We have a mix, all targeted for a slightly different segment. You know, some might be a mix of clients and prospects. Some might be purposely targeting the broader sort of third party network we have. You want to curate an event that the person attending really wants to come to. So that tends to be the differentiator. For example, it's a bit like going for a date. Sometimes the first date, you end up wanting to go to somewhere where you're not just going to be talking the whole time. You have an activity that sort of takes up some of the time and takes the pressure off. So that can be helpful with prospects in particular, you know, where you're going to an event where you're listening to a guest talk or there's a, you know, a panel discussion. And equally, if it's a little more networky, you know, drinks and canapes and, you know, nice food where you're working, you know, around a room, third parties tend to enjoy that more. It's part of their sort of job. But a private prospect might find that, you know, a little too much, too early. So there's those sort of considerations that go in.
What are some of the best events you've done in terms of like network generation?
we were very lucky to have a couple of very fantastic supporters of the business give sort of Chatham House rule style audience with. So we've had to date John Sopel, Sir Richard Moore, the ex-head of MI6. And from that perspective, it's a great opportunity for clients to get something that is an event they wouldn't normally be invited to. So it's got that money can't buy appeal that has a direct link back to the business and helps demonstrate that we are a bit different in this space. And with the quality of our events, hopefully allows people to translate across the quality of the proposition they'll be receiving if they did come on as a client.
Definitely. And you got new clients in the back of them.
Yes. And it's always hard to create a one-for-one link to an event to a...
Well, it's a process, isn't it?
It is. But there are definitely, I think, through the events program, cemented fantastic relationships or helped someone who might not have heard about Conor Brawley and might have felt, who are these people? And feel, oh no, this is immediately a feeling of quality as they engage with the business.
Mm. And just finally, Alex, so obviously we're into 2026 now. New year. Can you tell us a little bit about what your plans are this year, what you hope to achieve in 2026 for a firm and for a managing director?
So one of the big projects we have, which is a bit operational and a bit boring, is reviewing our contract with our incumbent SEI. So our term is coming up to an end. So that's a big review of the marketplace, see where everyone has got to since we last ran this process 7 years ago.
You're going to stick with them?
I think we're keeping a really open mind. They have been a great provider and really helped us get to where we want to be as a wealth manager over the last 5 years. But I always want to ensure that we're giving a best shot to everyone else and ensure that we have the best tech stack possible. But there was nothing that was wrong with SEI. But again, always important to
scope the market out.
So that's a big project. And then really for us, it is driving that sort of organic growth. It's being able to recognize that we need to find more of those people who will tap someone on the shoulder and ensuring that our senior management team is doing all we can and our planners and investment managers and benefits consultants are all working to a strategy that's going to maximize that. Because I think we have this sense of once someone comes across us, it's normally a very strong possibility of conversion. It's just getting people through the front door. So how do we get more people through the front door? That's the key challenge for 2026.
Maybe more podcasts, you know.
More podcasts would be part of it.
Great. Well, Alex, I think on that note, we're almost out of time. So thank you so much for joining.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
But today is VE Day. The war is
over. The newly crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.